This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
It's Fed Day and the holidays are almost upon us. Come on, how much better can it get? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It's Wednesday, the 19th of December. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The macroeconomic story we are going to tell you today is a story of, what's the story of one, two, three, four, five words, and is really exhibit A of how closely parsed the words of the Federal Reserve can be, especially when, as now, things are just beginning to feel a little bit squishy. The Fed wrapped up its two-day meeting on interest rates this afternoon, and as they do after every meeting, Chair Powell and company put out a statement. It runs about a page, their statement does, gives the Fed's rationale for its decision on rates. They raised rates today, by the way. But it also gives people some clue as to what the central bank thinks the interest rate future might hold. So what we're going to do, if it's all right with you, is a little audio compare and contrast between the operative sentence of the statement from their November meeting and the same sentence from today's statement, all right? All right, so here we go. This is from the statement after the November meeting.
The committee expects that further gradual increases in the target range for the federal funds rate will be consistent with sustained expansion of economic activity, strong labor market conditions, and inflation near the committee's symmetric 2% objective over the medium term.
The key bit was right at the beginning. It was followed by a whole lot of Fed speak, so I apologize for that. Back in November, they were thinking about further gradual increases in interest rates. Got that in your mind? Further gradual increases? All right, so here is today's statement.
The committee judges that some further gradual increases in the target range for the federal funds rate will be consistent with sustained expansion of economic activity, strong labor market conditions, and inflation near the committee's symmetric 2% objective over the medium term.
All right, you get it? It went by pretty quick. More Fed speak boilerplate there as well. So here you go one more time.
The committee judges that some further gradual increases in the target range.
Judge that some increases might be necessary versus expect gradual increases. I know you think I'm nuts making a big deal out of this, but I promise you, billions, trillions of dollars really hang on what the Fed is going to do with interest rates. And some of those trillions are coming from you in the form of higher rates on credit cards and mortgages and all of the rest. So honestly, not so nuts. All right, that was three words. Here are the other two of the five as promised. Dovish and hawkish. Those are words Fed watchers use to refer to the Fed's, well, mood, I guess, for lack of a better word. A dovish Fed is one that's not so worried about inflation and so might not be as inclined to raise interest rates, which is kind of how today's Fed statement read, right? Gradual judges, all of that. Remember that? The problem is that what Wall Street heard from Chairman Powell's press conference was more hawkish, that is, worried about inflation and so more likely to raise rates, which explains why all three major indices turned belly up as he was speaking. One more thing about the Fed, because I guess all of that wasn't enough, but they did say they are just a bit concerned about the global economy and some signs that global growth is slowing down. And that, in a very long way of speaking, gets us to a guy by the name of Fred Smith. Seriously.
I'll just conclude by saying
this Fred Smith, though, is the founder and CEO of FedEx.
Most of the issues that we're dealing with today,
he was talking yesterday on the company's quarterly earnings call,
are induced by bad political choices.
And it was an ugly earnings call.
Creating a tremendously difficult situation with Brexit.
FedEx is going to ship a record number of packages this holiday season, Smith said.
The immigration crisis in Germany.
But it's also cutting its earnings forecast.
The mercantilism and state-owned enterprise initiatives in China.
By 10%.
the tariffs that the United States put in unilaterally.
You add it all up, Smith says.
So you just go down the list, and they're all things that have created macroeconomic slowdowns.
Marketplace's Justin Ho updates us now on the shipping industry and the global economy.
It's hard to find a street in Manhattan that doesn't have a FedEx truck parked at the curb, with delivery workers chucking packages onto the sidewalk. But e-commerce delivery is only about a quarter of FedEx's business, says Satish Jindal, president of the logistics consultant ShipMatrix.
Almost 75 to 80% of what they're moving is for manufacturers, for electronics, for hardware.
For all the stuff companies need to do business. But because of all those things Fred Smith cited, Brexit, tariffs, and so on, companies are hesitating before putting in big orders. And FedEx has noticed. Dale Rogers teaches supply chain management at Arizona State University.
They can tell immediately if their planes and trucks are more full than they were a few weeks ago or less full.
FedEx can even feel a slowdown before it appears in other indicators, like GDP.
It's kind of like Paul Revere writing and saying the British are coming. It's an early indicator of what's happening in the economy.
It's also an indicator of what's already happening, says Steve Hanke at Johns Hopkins.
If China slows down and is slowing down, you will see the level of international trade going down. So, of course, FedEx is on top of this.
And FedEx isn't alone. In the last couple months, the Swiss freight giant Kuhne and Nagel noted that global trade is slowing. And so did the Danish shipping company Maersk. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
All right, one last thing about that Fed meeting today, I promise. And what the president has had to say about the central bank lately, especially the tweet yesterday about ignoring the data that we told you about. At one point during his press conference this afternoon, Chair Powell got this question.
President Trump said recently that you should feel the markets. So when you see the markets, you know, what are the markets telling you?
You know, financial conditions.
You can't see this because it's radio, but the chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States basically looked at that guy and gave him one of those, kind of eye roll shrugs before answering the question. It was great. I'll tell you what, the markets were not feeling the Fed's rate hike today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. How much trouble is Facebook in? Let me count the ways. The District of Columbia sued the company today for sharing users' personal data with the consulting firm Cambridge Analytica before the 2016 election, but that may be the least of it. An investigation by the New York Times shows Facebook has been sharing way more of its users' data with other companies than we realized. Partnerships with more than 150 companies in all. Well, those partnerships gave Microsoft's Bing access to the names of users' friends without consent. Amazon got its hands on users' names and contact info. Also, Netflix and Spotify. And for some reason, the Royal Bank of Canada were given the ability to read users' private messages. Now, never mind the privacy issue, but why would companies even want to do all of that reading of messages? Marketplace's Amy Scott is on that one.
If someone at Spotify read my private Facebook messages, they would know that I met my cousin for a beer and that a friend just got married. What's the playlist for that?
All of our data are extremely valuable.
That's Tiffany Lee, a fellow at Yale Law School's Information Society Project. According to the Interactive Advertising Bureau, companies will spend nearly $20 billion this year acquiring and processing consumer data. Lee says, in theory, Spotify could use information it gleaned about me or my friends to recommend songs or tailor advertising.
So essentially, they would have more ammunition to make you a long, happy customer of theirs.
Spotify, Netflix, and the Royal Bank of Canada all acknowledge partnerships with Facebook, but said they never accessed users' private messages. Jen King is director of consumer privacy with Stanford Center for Internet and Society.
I tend to actually believe most of these companies when they say they probably weren't interested in your messages.
Partly because it would take a lot of work to get much meaning from those messages. But Ed Mirzwinski with the U.S. Public Interest Research Group, a consumer watchdog, says as far as companies are concerned, the more data, the better.
When a company like Spotify gets offered access by Facebook, hey, do you want fries with that? They say, yeah, give us all of it.
even, he says, if they don't know how they're going to use it. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
President Trump seems, emphasis on the we don't really know yet part, to have softened his stance on border wall funding as a make or break part of not shutting down the government come Friday. Mr. Trump tweeted this morning, as he is wont to do, that Mexico would pay for the wall through the new NAFTA agreement, now known as the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement. It's an idea he's mentioned more than a couple of times, but so far the White House has not provided any details on that. So Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson made some calls today to try to figure out how likely it is that the USMCA would somehow provide funding for a wall.
So it seems extremely unlikely that USMCA will provide funding for a border wall. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace. Okay, let's actually dig into this idea that the updated NAFTA could help pay for a border wall. At a White House press briefing yesterday, Sarah Huckabee Sanders said the updated deal would generate revenue and savings that would pay for the wall four times over. Jennifer Hillman teaches international trade at Georgetown Law Center.
I think the chances that it would generate additional revenue are very slim to none.
Hillman says the original NAFTA pretty much wiped out tariffs between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada. So the only way she can imagine additional revenue from USMCA is if its updated auto provisions actually wind up making more imported cars subject to tariffs. But even so, she says those tariffs would be paid by American importers.
So there is no way under the USMCA that would provide for Mexico to be adding revenues into the United States.
In general, the updated USMCA just isn't that substantially different from the old NAFTA, says Kent Smetters, director of the Penn Wharton budget model.
But even if we're being really generous and using heroic assumptions here, the additional revenue would not even cover annual maintenance on the wall.
Theoretically, the agreement could help the U.S. economy grow faster than it otherwise would have, which could boost government tax revenues, says Simon Lester with the Cato Institute. But even then,
the executive branch can't just take additional tax revenue and spend it on a wall. It has to be appropriated by Congress.
Which would leave the White House in a very similar situation to the one it's in today. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
We've been doing a project this year about the last 10 years in this economy and how the financial crisis and the Great Recession changed so many things for so many people. Today, the story of 53-year-old James Strebler. He's out of Lambertville, Michigan.
In 2008, I was a small business person. My company, we were really at the intersection of housing and insurance, and my business was in Southeast Michigan. So it was just the wrong place to be. In 2012, midway through 2012, I had to close the doors of the business, and then that was it. I had lost everything. My business, my job, I was in the process of losing my home. Pretty much everything in my life had just been curb stomped. And when you lose that much that quickly, you have to set priorities. And really, the only priorities I had at that point were, first off, that this doesn't blow back onto my son. I don't want him to be harmed. And secondly, that I wanted to be as good a father as I could possibly be under the circumstances. I have this son, and at the time he's just in middle school. He doesn't understand any of this stuff. So I found a job, but it was not great pay, and it was 2.5 hours away from my home. And so I'm basically commuting 30 hours a week. Bad things are going to happen in life, but being a father was always so important to me, and I lost so much of that. You don't ever get those years back. Those are the ones where when you're 75 years old and looking back on your life, you wish you had spent more time with your kids. And that opportunity was taken away from me for 3.5 years because of the crisis. What irritated me was that I knew that to the government that looked like a success story. And I think a lot of people are just in that boat where we've found some way to get by, but it's really nowhere near where we were at the start of the financial crisis. Even now, I make less money in real dollar terms, forget inflation adjusted, than I made in 1997. I fear for the opportunities for my son because I'm a little bit afraid of what the economy is going to look like going forward. When I was young, you would hear this generation after generation. People would say, I want my kids to have it better than I did. That was intrinsic to the American dream. I haven't heard a person say that in 10 years.
We've done a look back at our coverage this past year for a project about how the financial crisis changed this country. Divided Decade, it's called. And we pulled together some lessons learned. We posted housing online the other day. This Wednesday, we have added our look at jobs and unemployment and what has changed since 2008. It's at marketplace.org/divided decade. Coming up.
I'm not fulfilling my purpose as an artist if I'm not being true to these stories.
Stephan James, starring in If Beale Street Could Talk, on why he does what he does. But first, let's us do the numbers. Yeah, the Wawas, and I'll tell you what, it did not look like that early in the day, but then the Fed chair started talking and it was all over. Stocks gave up an early rally, closed sharply lower. Dow Industrials off 351, 1.4%, closed at 23,323. The NASDAQ gave back 147, 2.1%, 6636. S&P 500 slid 39 points, 1.5%, 2506. Not a great day for FedEx. As Justin was telling us earlier, the shipper cited slowing global trade for its troubles. Down 12% today for Fred Smith's company. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.76%. Wow, I missed that. You're listening to Marketplace. You make financial decisions every day, from minor transactions to major life choices. And that's why Marketplace covers the economy from so many different angles, connecting the dots between the micro and the macro. As a nonprofit organization, we depend on individuals like you to help us provide trustworthy news that adds value to your life. If you're not yet a Marketplace investor, please contribute today at marketplace.org, and your gift will be matched dollar for dollar. And thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. In London today, a key part of Uber's business model took a big hit from the United Kingdom's Court of Appeal in a ruling that said drivers for the ride-sharing service aren't freelancers working in the gig economy. They are actually company employees and are so entitled to benefits and a minimum wage. Back here, the 75,000 Uber drivers in New York City are going to be eligible for a minimum wage starting in mid-January. That applies to drivers for Lyft and other apps as well. It's the first minimum wage for those drivers in this country. And for a lot of them, it's going to work out to a big raise, more than 40%. Janet Babin has that one.
Hi, are you Uber?
Janet?
Yes.
By the time my Uber driver, Cornell Iacob, picks me up for a morning trip to New York's LaGuardia Airport, his work day is almost done. But he says his work week feels never-ending.
I work 7 days a week. Seven. You cannot do it part-time, and I explained you why.
Iacob started driving for Uber 3 years ago after he got laid off from a desk job he had for almost 2 decades. With 2 kids still in school, he tapped his retirement savings to buy a car for work. As a ride-hail driver, Iacob's an independent contractor, not an employee. That means he has to pay all his own expenses.
Your car, your gas, your insurance, your repairs.
After all those bills, what's left?
It's nothing, absolutely nothing. It's really not worth it.
Iacob says driving in the city has taken a toll on his car, but he can't afford a new one. Advocates say the pressure on drivers is extreme. Bhairavi Desai is the executive director of the New York Taxi Workers Alliance, a labor group that represents taxicab and rideshare drivers.
When there is such a deep crisis among this workforce.
Uber started off paying drivers about 80% of the fares collected from customers. But a few years ago, the company reduced the amount it passes on to drivers. Now, Desai says in some cases, drivers make 60% or less of what passengers pay for a ride.
It's not the driver that's getting the lion's share of that fare, even though that fare was only possible because of the driver's labor.
An economic study commissioned by New York City backs Desai up. Economist James Parrott with the Center for New York City Affairs at the New School analyzed what drivers earn on a per-trip basis.
We found that 96% of all drivers have one or more trips per week where they earn less than the independent contractor equivalent of the minimum wage.
New York City's minimum wage will rise to $15 per hour at the end of this year. Independent contractors need to earn a bit more to clear that rate because they have to pay higher payroll taxes and cover their own vacation time. So the equivalent minimum for them is $17.22 an hour. Earlier this month, New York City's Taxi and Limousine Commission set that as the new minimum for rideshare drivers. Parrott estimates that as a result of the increase, drivers' net pay after expenses will rise by a bit more than 40% annually, or about $10,000. The ride-hail companies aren't happy about the change. Lyft didn't respond to our requests, and in a statement, Uber said the higher pay floor will extend wait times and raise fares. But Parrott disagrees.
You know, these are companies that are taking a pretty significant commission share out of the passenger fare. So there's some leeway there for them to reduce their commissions.
Other cities will be watching closely, since New York could offer a roadmap for municipalities that want to regulate the ride-hail industry. Would-be Uber and Lyft investors will be watching, too. Both companies are planning IPOs for sometime next year, says analyst James Messiter with Strategy Analytics.
If a lot of other cities start picking up on this, I think it could have an effect, but I just don't see that happening.
New York's minimum wage for rideshare drivers takes effect in mid-January. In New York, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Speaking of driving, coming up tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report, sure, gas is cheap, but you know what a national average of $2.36 a gallon does? It gets more people on the road is what? Traffic is the lump of coal in your Christmas stock, and that's tomorrow on The Morning Show. The Hollywood Awards season is about to start in earnest. The Golden Globes are January the 6th. Oscar nominations are coming out a couple of weeks later. Various and sundry other recognitions in between. And one film you're almost certainly going to hear a whole lot about is the latest from Barry Jenkins. He did Moonlight, you might remember. The new one is called If Beale Street Could Talk, the story of a man arrested and imprisoned for a crime he didn't commit. Stephan James has the lead role, and he's having a pretty good year as well, starring in another very buzzy show, the Amazon series Homecoming. Stephan James, welcome to the program.
Thank you, man. Thank you for having me.
I want to talk about both of these things, Homecoming and Beale Street. But I want to talk about Beale Street first, because that, I think, is the one that's getting the splash at the moment. And I want to ask how you came to be in this movie.
Well, I've been a big fan of Barry Jenkins for a long time.
Yeah, same here.
And so I read the script, and I was kind of blown away because I felt like the character of Fonny was almost written for me. It was almost made for me. And so I told my managers, I said, I have to do anything to be a part of this film. So I ended up sending Barry a couple scenes. And then I asked him if he would meet me for lunch. And he,
how does one go about doing that? Getting Barry Jenkins and saying, do you want to have lunch?
I mean, hey, you just got to be bold enough to do it, I guess. You know, I asked him, and truly, I didn't know what to expect. He could have ignored me. He could have said, you know, there's no way I'm meeting you, kid. But, you know, I pretty much begged him to be a part of it.
All right, this is a little off the wall, but I'm going to throw it out there anyway. Acting is a job, right? So what's it like to have acting be your job, I guess, is the question.
It doesn't feel like a job. I mean, I just feel like if it ever felt like work, I'd stop doing it. I have a blast doing what I do.
So two things about that. Number one, you said it's been a long time. You're like, what, 24? Four?
I just made 25 on Sunday.
Oh, well, clearly now it's all downhill from here. I mean,
exactly.
It's amazing success at a young age, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've been very, very fortunate. Mind you, I've been acting now for 10 years. So, Yeah. You know, to just sort of be in this position now where more people are starting to get to see your work and appreciate it, it's a pretty cool feeling.
Yeah, I want to, and just to follow up on that previous answer, You have said recently, actually, about why you do movies. One of the things you ask yourself is why should we tell this story? Why does it matter to make a movie like this? And you're talking about Beale Street specifically. So what was it about Beale Street that spoke to you, that made you want to do the film?
Man, you know what? When I read, this is my first time reading Baldwin.
Yeah, James Baldwin, we should say, the guy who wrote the book on which Beale Street is based.
Exactly. So, you know, it's my first time reading a James Baldwin novel. And what really struck me about this story is that even though Baldwin wrote these words in 1974, they resonated so heavily in 2018. I mean, like literally these issues of mass incarceration, issues of false imprisonment are front page news today. So, you know, to me, it just felt like it was bigger than me. It felt like I had a real story to tell. Even though they're fictional characters, they're very representative of real people even today. So it just felt important to be able to share the story.
not to put too much on the shoulders of Stephon James at the age of now 25, but the other big project you've got going, Homecoming, on Amazon from Sam Esmail, he's the guy who did Mr. Robot, has a lot of those same characteristics, right? What people in this country, specifically veterans, are going through.
Yeah, I agree. You know, people make the comparison all the time. I think that it's funny because Walter Cruz in Homecoming, he sort of wants to be in this institution. With Fonny and Beale Street, you know, this is the last place he wants to be, is institutionalized, mm-hmm. especially wrongfully. So I think they're a little bit different, but just a really cool thing for me to do both of those projects back to back.
Stephon James, you can see him in Homecoming on Amazon, and also If Beale Street Could Talk, the new film by Barry Jenkins. Stephon, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Appreciate you, man. Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, in which UPS is, I think, bending the space-time continuum. The company announced this morning that it expects its peak return day, which is, just like it sounds, the day it handles the most return packages, to be today, Wednesday, the 19th, not, say, next Wednesday, the 26th. Think about it for a minute. It'll make some sense. The spike, the company said, is due in part, and this is a quote, to self-gifting, which I just think is cheating the whole spirit of the season, really. All right, we got to go. Think back to the top of the program and hawkish and dovish and which one of those Wall Street heard. The Dow off 1.4% today. The Nasdaq fell 2.25%. S&P 500 dropped about 1.5%. Sarah Bergere, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostedt, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered the program for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.